Welcome back to Financial Therapy. Take a moment right now just to imagine following your dreams, or imagine doing a profession that you loved so much that you would do it for free. What about leaving everything you know behind to follow an uncommon path? In this episode of Financial Therapy, we are going to explore what inspires people to choose, say, their passion over a regular paycheck. We're heading out to discover what money is like on the road less traveled, where individuals make less standard choices about how they make money, and what are the driving forces that inspire them to do so. I'm calling it Money on the Road Less Traveled. My first guest's passion has meant that he has performed in front of 3.8 billion people. It was conducting the Sydney Symphony Orchestra at the Sydney Olympics opening ceremony. Imagine over half the world's population watching you do your day job. George Ellis is a conductor and composer whose work has taken him around the world, working with the likes of the late Lou Reed and transforming the songs of David Bowie into orchestral masterpieces. And he happens to be a good mate. So, George Ellis, thank you so much for being on Financial Therapy.
Hi, Jane. Good to be here.
So, for those that may not know about what you do and your work, can you tell us a little bit about what you do?
Okay, so I am an orchestral conductor. I'm freelance. I work for myself. I production companies, different kinds of arts companies and organizations hire me to put orchestras together for them to put on concerts. That's mostly what I do, but I also compose and do orchestral arrangements depending on the need for the job. So, for example, the last composing work I did was I composed the soundtrack to a short documentary film by Bruce Beresford. So I compose, I do orchestrations, and I conduct for a living, predominantly orchestral, but sometimes vocal as well.
Yeah. So, look, I'm really interested in discussing this idea about why some people follow their passion over, say, following the paycheck. And can you just tell me a little bit about when you were started to be interested in music and your passion sort of started?
Yes, sure. Well, I have an older brother who's 3 years older than me. So when I was about five, maybe six, he was learning piano. And I wanted to go to piano lessons as well. It looked fascinating to me. It sounded fascinating to me. So I pestered my parents to take me to lessons. But they said I was too young, but I insisted. So I went at an early age. Soon after, my older brother stopped lessons. So I took his lessons. So I was going to two lessons a week because I loved. So I started lessons, and then I kept on going with it. I did that all the way through high school. Formed rock bands when I was in high school, but I was also learning some classical music as well. But my parents didn't want me to pursue music. I didn't really know what I knew. I wanted to study music, I didn't want to study music. I wanted to play music, but I didn't know how I was going to go about that. So because I didn't have a plan, my parents wanted me to go to university. So I went to university. I studied something completely non-related to anything I was wanting to do. I think I was doing science. I took some computers were coming up then as an important thing. So I took some computer science classes. I wasn't interested in any of it. I was playing in a rock band at the time. The rock band broke up. I failed university. So I was thinking, what is it that I'm going to do with my life? I knew I wanted to do music. My parents wanted me to study. So I happened to come across somebody, a friend of mine, who was studying music at the Conservatorium of Music, or at least said they wanted to go and study music at the Conservatorium. So that sparked an idea in me to really work hard and practice on instruments that I was learning, including piano, including guitar, including cello, and then I auditioned to get into the conservatorium 2 years after high school. So the year after high school, I went to university and failed that. Then the year after that, so the second year out of high school, I just practiced and practiced and practiced to get into the conservatorium. And at the end of that year, I auditioned to get into the Conservatorium of Music, and I enrolled in a Bachelor of Music Education. And from there on, my career, what I wanted to do in music is that's where it all started.
What happened with your parents when you said, okay, I mean, obviously you said you failed at university. What was the conversation like when you said, well, look, I failed at the uni that you wanted me to do, but I'm going to go and do this other thing? What was it that they said to you?
It was tense. There were fights. They said, well, okay, so you didn't do well at university in that area, so find something else. You've got to stay at university. You must get a university degree. Prior to that, when I was about 14, 15, I kept on going with the music lessons. And they said to me, so why are you still doing music lessons? And I said, well, you know, you gave them to me. I know I insisted on them, but you gave them to me when I was young, and I love this now. I want to keep going. They said, okay, but we just wanted it to be a hobby for you. And I understand that thinking. That's a fair enough and reasonable thing to want. I mean, every parent, of course, I assume, wants their child to prosper in life, and they didn't see that a musician of any kind would be able to prosper financially. So when I kept up the lessons, and when I was playing in the bands, I was spending all my time playing music and learning music, they said to me, well, why are you still doing that? And, of course, the reason for me was because I love it and this is what I want to do. Now, I didn't know how to go about making music. I mean, the band tried and we made a record, and we used to support bands, you know, be support acts for bands like Mental as Anything and Cold Chisel, etc. But other than that, I wasn't sure how to make a living out of music. So when my parents insisted that I go to university, I did, not reluctantly, but also not enthusiastically. I thought, well, they're right, maybe I can still play music, but maybe I should have some kind of career. But it wasn't sitting well with me. I was spending much more time with the rock band and having lessons than I was with any of my studies at university. So when I wasn't doing well and I said I wanted to leave, they said, you mustn't leave. And there were fights. I mean, I was living at home at the time, in my early 20s, late teens, early 20s, and there were fights. They said, I must stay at university. And I said, no, I don't want to. Basically, they got quite angry at me, and I said, well, you can't make me go to university. So I left, and, if that answers your question, it was tense, it was hard, and they thought, you know, I said to them, I want to go study at the conservatorium. They said, well, what will you be able to do? And I said, well, I'm going to go and find out. I have to follow, and I know it's a cliche, but I have to follow my passion, and my passion was music. And I thought it was a perfect combination. As I said before, I wanted to play music. They wanted me to study. Well, I was at the conservatorium studying. So for me, it was good. They weren't sure how it was going to turn out, and possibly I wasn't either, but I enrolled at first year. Luckily, I got in. I passed the audition, and I enrolled at first year conservatorium, and I just fell in love with every single thing I was learning. And I can go on about that with how it happened from there as to how my career took off. But that's how it all started, by me leaving it, then taking a year off to really hone my craft, learn my piano scales, you know, train my ear. So when I had the audition to get into the conservatorium, I knew how to answer their questions and to play the ability. So it all started then 2 years after high school.
So just interesting, if you reflect on that period, you know, the fighting and things like that, did you just deeply know, and even the risk of your perceptions of your parents, that it was just, you just knew, or you just wanted it so much, and that was the thing that drove that difficult conversations?
I was finding out. What I did know was not pursuing music wasn't for me.
Yeah.
Not pursuing music was not the right thing for me because I tried it. Now, okay, I didn't give it a good red hot go, but that's because I didn't want to. I was not interested in it. Okay, I was interested in making sure I wasn't living on the street, and you know, I was interested in being able to buy, you know, food and have somewhere to live. But I was sure I was interested in that. But I was in terms of a career. I had tried something else. And maybe, you know, if I'd followed their advice, I would have maybe found something else and found a career out of that. But to answer your question, I didn't know, but I was finding out. I was working out what to know, how was it that music was going to help me. I didn't really know. But luckily, I discovered that when I was studying at the conservatorium.
You know, a lot of people, if they're lucky enough, will get some, particularly when they're doing the road less traveled, that they get support systems and mentors. And, you know, you were very fortunate to get into a conservatorium where people are really cultivating that possibility for you, you know, that, yes, you can make a career.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, in the year that I auditioned, there are many more audition now, I think, but back then in the early to mid-80s when I auditioned for my year there, I think there were 200 applicants and there were 50 positions, 50, you know, acceptances. So I think it's a much smaller percentage now. So, you know, many more apply and less get in. But, you know, so I was lucky to be, you know, 50, one of the 50 of the 200 that auditioned. I was probably number 49 or 50, I reckon. But anyway, I loved it. I mean, I was studying with musicians, music students, and I'm not just trying to be humble. I believe it to be true, and that is I was studying with my fellow students who were much more talented than me. They had been doing music since, you know, they were little. So had I, but they had done it in school. They really, you know, they were very, very talented students. Some of them I still see a lot of them, and they're my friends. And one of them I work with now, and he's a top professional musician. Anyway, so I had to work hard in order to keep up and to do well. And it wasn't hard for me to work hard. I mean, when I was at university, I didn't want to study. I didn't want to do any of the assignments. But when I was at the conservatorium, I mean, I sat up the front for 4 years at every lecture because I hung on to every single word any of my lecturers said, regardless of the subject matter, you know, whether it was the history of the music from the Middle Ages or whether it was, you know, Indian music and, you know, Ravi Shankar. Or anything like that, I hung on to everyone. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And I worked hard at it. And I did well, if I may say, in terms of grades. Mm-hmm. I did really, really well. And I loved it. And so during my 4 years at the Conservatorium of Music, we had to take a class that involved conducting orchestras. And I really liked that class and I really liked my lecturer. And my lecturer, so this is in my third year at the conservatorium, he asked me to meet him in his office and I did. And he said to me, this is what you need to be doing. Conducting is your profession. So I'm going to have a scholarship for you to go and study conducting at the University of Colorado. And also through the conservatorium, I went to Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh to study composition and orchestration. And then at the end of that short course, I went to the University of Colorado to do a master's degree in conducting. So from the early days, my first year at the Conservatorium of Music, where I was doing music education subjects, performance subjects, learning cello, doing piano, learning history of music, doing ear training and oral and theory, harmony and all things like that, where I wasn't exactly sure where I was going to be going into a music profession, all of a sudden this one class, this conducting class, which did involve some composition, my lecturer called me out and he said, you have talent in this. And I thought, oh, really? Do I? I know I like it, but I don't know. I didn't know I was doing it well. He said, you're doing very well. You're going to get a good grade in this class. For at the end of next year, when you graduate, we're going to get you over to America. Because at the time, So we're talking 1987. There were no postgraduate courses in music in Australia, but there are now, of course, but there weren't then. And he got his doctorate from the University of Colorado, so that's why he put me in touch there with that university. And I went to that university on scholarship to study. I was there for 3 years studying conducting.
Yeah.
So it all sprang from there.
Yeah. So just listening to you, I just hear this this kind of design, like you were designed for this. You were made for it in a way. And, you know, how does that, because a lot of people come into life and then they go, I don't know what I'm made for, or I don't know what, or like myself, you know, you go through life and then you kind of land on something and you go, ah, maybe this is where I landed. But for you, it sounds like the way you talk about it, you were kind of made that way. Is that right? Is that how you see it?
I'll see if I can answer the question, which is a very good question, this way, and that is, what I do know is my love for it.
Mm.
What I do know is that I have a deep, you know, unfailing, unending love for music of all kind. Am I made for it? I don't know, perhaps, but what I do know for sure is that anything to do with music, whether I'm listening to it, working in it, creating it, it just nourishes me. I know it's a bit, I don't know, cliche to say, but it nourishes my soul in every single way. I love it with such a passion that to be able to make that as my living was a dream. And so I guess in the end I'm living that dream. I don't know about made for it. I do know, because I love it so much, I work really hard. I've since day one of the Conservatorium of Music in 1984, I have worked really, really hard, solidly, daily, weekly basis, monthly basis, year in, year out. I work really hard on everything that I'm doing in music, but it's really easy for me to do so because I love it so much, as I said before. So let's say I've had a really busy day and I'm not too tired and I can work, starting at midnight. It can be, not that I do this on a regular basis or at all lately, but I could say start working at midnight and it can be 4 a.m. before I know it, because when I start music, it's just... it keeps me awake. It's like, you know, I'm charged into the wall via electricity, because music is just so powerful to me. I can't explain it, and I know it sounds a little bit over the top, but music to me is just words fail me. What music? I couldn't express to you in words what music means to me.
I'm just so touched by what you're saying. You know, I find this subject, this sort of issues of survival and therapy and what makes us happy as humans, and I love it like that.
Yeah.
I know that feeling. It feels like it makes my – there's a really lovely term in Yiddish, gewelling, which is like my heart just goes like pops.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's like full and it's like my heart singing.
Beautiful.
And I know exactly what you mean, that place that it just, I could be working or studying or thinking about, you know, these issues of what we have around, you know, mental health, and 4 o'clock and it turns up. And in a way, when I said sort of made of it, I mean that I was kind of designed that way, or, you know.
I was certainly designed to love it. I know that. it's always, my mother tells me when I was really little, like, you know, probably a toddler, where if we were in the shops, in the shopping center, and there was one shop that had music playing on, I had to stop outside that shop or go inside to listen to the music. So somehow music has always been this amazing, you know, attraction to me, and it hasn't stopped. And so not one single day of my studies or my career since, you know, that first day at the Conservatorium in 1984 have I ever thought, I'm a little bit over music. I've never done any I've never done any concert where I thought, oh, yeah, it's just another concert. No, I mean, I even do sometimes, because these days, and we can get to this, you know, when it's appropriate, but, you know, these days I do all kinds of different musics. Like I put orchestras together with pop music and rock music. And, you know, there's music that I really love of pop music, like Beatles and David Bowie and et cetera. And that's not hard for me to do. But sometimes, see, for example, I don't love heavy metal music. It's just not my favorite style of music. But, you know, I've done putting symphony orchestras together with heavy metal music. But because it's symphony orchestra, even though I don't love heavy metal music, I still love that as well. Music just holds such a place in my whole being, not just my heart, but my whole being, that it's just so, it's the opposite to soporific, whatever that word is, you know, energizer. It's like, even if I get tired, if I'm doing music, I'll stay up for 72 hours because it's just such a, you were just talking about it with your wonderful Yiddish term. It's exactly the same.
I know you've got two kids. Do you do that with them? Do you say follow your dream? Is that more likely what you do with them than, say, you know, something that's a bit more practical? What do you do with the kids?
You know, it's funny. My daughter, Bronte, she went to University of Western Sydney for, I think, a term or half a semester. And she called me one day, you know, middle of the day, middle of the week, Wednesday or something. And she said, Dad, I've got some bad news. Or I don't know if she said bad news, but she, you know, she didn't make it sound like it was going to be that I was going to love what she was going to say next. And she said, Dad, you know, I want to leave university and I'm thinking of going to study music. Is that bad? Is that all right? And I said, do you know me? don't you know, don't you, that I went to university and I left it and I wanted to go and study music instead? I said, of course. I don't know if that answers your question, but yeah, I was totally okay. I was very happy for my children to follow their dream, follow their passion. It would have been very critical of me to say, no, you must go to university. In relation to that, when my children were little, my daughter and my son were little, I did take them. I mean, their mother is a music teacher, so they had no hope but to get to have music. They couldn't escape music and music education. So I did give them, you know, arrange for them to have music lessons. And that was not because I necessarily wanted them to do music. I mean, I would have been very happy if they said yes or no. But what I didn't want was that for them to be, you know, 17 years old and say, Dad, I love music. I want to go and you know, play cello in an orchestra. How come, especially given you're a conductor, why didn't I learn music when I was 5 years old? Mm. Now I can't do music. So I wanted to give them that opportunity, and then for them at 17 to say, yes, great, I'm really grateful for that, I'm going to study music, or no, it's not for me, I'd rather be a vet, I'd rather be a nurse, so whatever it is they wanted. And then that's okay. That wouldn't have been a waste. That, you know, a music education is a lovely thing to do, even if you don't take it up for a living. But what I couldn't risk was them not to have the education and the opportunity, and for them to say, hang on, I can't now pursue it for a career because it's too late. You can't learn an instrument at 19 years old. I mean, you know, you can, but it's so, to make it a living, to be a professional at it, you have to start young. That's the only thing about music. You do have to start young if you want to make it a living.
Yeah. Often something that's talked around, particularly for people that are in musicians, is that, or musics or in the arts, is that piece around you have a certain amount of talent. You might have 5% talent, but most of it is, you know, sticking it out, being tenacious, you know, all the blood, sweat and tears. Do you believe in that? Is that something that you, you know, would teach anyone that's going to ask you, you know, look, you know, you've got to have a certain amount of talent, but most of it's going to be blood, sweat and tears.
I think, yes, the answer is yes to that. But there are three important components, probably in this order of importance, to to absolutely love it. And going on from that, that is, if it was taken away from you, you'd be crushed. If you didn't, let's say sports was your thing, and then all of a sudden you got an injury and you couldn't do sports anymore, it would absolutely just crush you. So to have a deep-seated and amazing and unending love for it, that's most important. Second of importance is to work, to answer your question, to work really, really hard at it, which isn't difficult to do when the first
you love it
when the first priority is in place. Third, to have some natural talent at it. I mean, if you can't be a singer, for example, and make a career out of singing if you can't sing. So you have to have some natural talent. But going backwards, to make it as a musician, talent on its own, without working hard, without the love for it, doesn't work.
Yeah.
Working hard at it alone, without the love for it, without the natural talent for it, also doesn't work. Loving it with all your heart, but not having the natural talent for it, not working hard. So all three are important. And even if the first one isn't there, that it's not your greatest love, but you have some natural talent at it, and more importantly, in direct answer to your question, if you work solidly and hard at it, you can do it. You can make it work. But those three things are really important. Is working harder more important than natural talent? I suspect yes, and I'm only saying that from personal experience. And again, I'm not just trying to be humble. I think I have limited talent. I don't have no talent at it. But I'm not really that talented. But because of my love for it, I've worked really hard at it. And so, from my own perspective, working hard is more important than any natural talent you have. But it's good to have both. Now, if you're really, really, really naturally talented at it, you probably don't have to work hard. Prime example, Mozart. Now, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart wrote his first symphony when I think he was 5. He wrote this amazing symphony, Symphony No. 25 in G minor. And when I ask my orchestras, do you know what age, when we play it, I ask them, do you know what age Mozart was when he wrote this symphony? And they say, no, I say he was 17, you know, and it sounds like something that's all his life he had worked on. So there, you can have lots of natural raw talent like Mozart did, and not have to work hard, and it just the music just comes out, or you can play the piano, you know, as a child prodigy. But there aren't that many Mozarts. I'm certainly not a Mozart, and I know very, very, very few Mozarts. So for those Mozarts out there, well done. I hate you. No, I don't. good for you. But for the rest of us, we have to work hard, and especially the less natural talent you have, the harder you have to work. And I know I've had to work very, very hard. But I go back to, and I know I'm repeating myself, but it isn't hard to work hard when it fills you with such joy.
love it. That's a really lovely, concise and applied, you know, way of answering that question. Thank you, George. That was beautiful. So I'm just going to change tack again. What often we see in most countries or most economies is that politics plays a role in whether arts is supported or not.
Yeah.
Personally, I've spent a bit of time in Cuba, and in Cuba, musicians are just as important as nurses and doctors and engineers and office workers.
Yeah.
One, because they value that kind of diversity. There is a contribution that even artists, visual artists as well as musicians and things like that, there's a contribution that the arts makes to a society beyond just the economy, just what creates, you know, the machinations of an economy.
Yeah.
As an artist, you would have an opinion about that, you know, I imagine you would.
Yes. Well, let me maybe it's maybe skirting the issue a little bit, but hopefully not. And let me say this, and that is, when I studied at the Conservatorium of Music in the mid-80s, I graduated, as I said before, in 1987. This was just before HECS. And so my education was free.
This is just hang on. Just for those international listeners, it's, HECS is a debt program, that meaning that you pay for the fees straight up front, and then once you start working, you need to pay that off.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's HECS. That's the Australian version.
So I guess I'm. Thank you for explaining that. I guess I meant education was no longer free. When I went through the conservatorium, which is now part of Sydney University, there were no fees. It was completely free. I am used to, and I also, and further to that, I remember the 1972 Australian federal election when Gough Whitlam got in, and one of his mandates was that university education would be free. So I was used to that. And when I went to university myself, or should I say tertiary education at the Conservatorium of Music, I did get a bachelor's degree. It was completely free. And that's expensive. That costs a lot of money. I mean, the government was paying, you know, all the conservatorium teachers. They were teaching us one-on-one. We're not talking classes of 1,000 or even classes of 30. They were teaching us individually. You know, that must have cost the government a packet. And I guess clearly that wasn't sustainable. However, for however long it lasted, it's amazing that education was free. Okay, so they had to put on the HECS, which you've explained, after that, and that makes sense. But idealistically, and I know, you know, this wouldn't get me into government if I was a politician, but ideally, or for me, idealistically, education would be free. And I'm trying to say that in relation to what you're talking about, government support. Do I wish there was government support completely like there is, say, in Cuba? I've just finished reading a book about the music education system in Venezuela. It's called El Sistema, or The System, where all students have an orchestra education for free. At least that's the way it was. I'm not sure that it's like that anymore. It was like that for years. And wonderful people like conductors like Gustavo Dudamel came out of that. He's now the chief conductor of the Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra. And so that's a really good system. Does it work politically? Does it work financially? Clearly not, because it's too hard. But do I wish it happened? Yes, I do. But that's being very idealistic. Does that talk to your question?
I think you've covered off something really interesting about that, because but it didn't, but that's okay. What I was, you know, just interesting to see that where certain societies, yeah, place funding, which is, you know, and also too, yeah, that, you know, Kate Blanchett also talks about the fact that she was a child of, you know, free education or free university.
Right.
It's, times have changed, and I totally get that. But I suppose the bit that I'm curious around is how, say, in, you know, political systems where arts funding was very, yes, you know, there was a big public policy or political policy to say, yes, we're going to put a lot of money into arts funding,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That means that there's lots of grants for film, lots of grants for music, lots of grants for venues, lots of everything.
Yes.
And political parties change, and then that funding goes again.
Yeah.
In the context of, you know, seeing how valuable, I mean, the arts is valuable. I believe it is. You obviously do. You know, can you talk to me a little bit about the fact that, yeah, you value it as an art form? I mean, of course, you're lucky enough to do it as a full-time career, but there are a lot of, you know, associated industries to do with the music, and it's still a valuable art form that needs to be, you know, part of the budget, basically.
Yes, I mean, yeah, so you're right. I clearly think it's a worthwhile thing. Oh, you know, art needs to be funded. Yes, for sure. Now, there are people, perhaps even listening to this, that would be on opposite sides of this, and that is that there would be people that say, you know, the arts are not funded nearly enough. And I couldn't say that they're wrong. I'm sure they're right. And then there are other people that say, but, you know, there's the Australia Council. APRA have grants and funds. There's this and this and this and that. And, you know, the Australian Music Centre, it provides fund, you know, for projects, et cetera, as long as you come up with a project that they believe, you know, would work. I sit somewhere, you know, I mean, I see all sides and I sit somewhere in the middle of that, I guess. And that is, I think there should be more funding. I mean, probably the prime example of that was, you know, and I must admit, I didn't really keep up with it because I had enough work, so I didn't need to go on to look for JobKeeper or JobSeeker during COVID. But from what I understand, for those people who did, freelancers like myself lost out. You know, they weren't able to apply for that because they, you know, they didn't have their regular income and they couldn't prove they couldn't show whatever they needed, their tax returns or whatever. But so that's a shame that those people, artists, you know, me really, and people like me fell through the cracks. Some of them, or if not all of them, needed it. I'm very fortunate to say, just personally, I didn't fall through the crack because I had enough work to keep going. Plus, I was doing some teaching at the conservatorium, so I didn't need to apply for funding of any kind or grants or whatever. Of course, I think it's important. I mean, to show my political bias here, and I don't know if I should be, but I loved what Paul Keating did. Paul Keating thought the Sydney Symphony Orchestra, you know, that's where the sun shone from. So his government funded it to the hilt, you know, and he had opposition to that. I'm not saying unjustifiably, but from my personal point of view, I thought it was fantastic. You know, personally speaking, and from my little bias corner, I think it would be fantastic if the arts. I see. To me, the arts are so important. I mean, you know, we need hospitals, right? Of course. Who's going to argue against that? We need schools. Who's going to argue against that? We need, you know, public works, we need roads, we need all these things. Do we need art? Well, in a very shallow sense, no, but on a much deeper and much better level, yes, we absolutely need it. Can you imagine life without stories, without music, without art, without being able to you know, imagine if there was no Picasso or Monet or Van Gogh. It would, you know, a black and white world would work, but none of us live in a black and white world. And why should we, when it's available to us? Should we fund it? Yes. Can we fund it more? That's for the politicians to answer. And, you know, the Liberal government, the right-wing government or the left-wing government might have different views on that. But the answer is definitely. I don't know how true the story is. You know, Winston Churchill said, you know, there wasn't money for arts because we're fighting a war. And I don't know if it's true, but apparently he or maybe someone else said, then what are we fighting for if we can't have art? You know, so that's however romantic or otherwise that is, that's a beautiful thing. And I hope it's true. I hope he said that because I believe in that. I personally, given that I earn my living from full-time living from music, I subscribe to that point of view.
Yeah. Oh, thank you, George. That's beautiful. Yeah, you just made me, as you're talking about that, it's obviously, you know, a COVID, lots of big industries are not functioning at the moment, particularly the tourism industry, but certainly the arts industry. And I'm really glad that you mentioned about certain areas of certain individuals that fell through the cracks because they are working in freelance, you know, and that they are putting color to the world that you so beautifully put.
Exactly. And so, you, but on that point, you know, this time last year, or maybe a little bit later in the year or early this year, as we all know, unfortunately, you know, Australia was battling bushfires. And I'm not the first to say it. This is not my idea or a new idea, but everybody said, look, especially when COVID and all those artists fell through the cracks, it was even people like Tony Burke said, they're the very people that played for us for free to to raise money to fight, you know, to give to the bush fire brigade to fight the bushfires. That's a really important thing. So here are these people being left behind by the government, and yet they're the same people that are helping the government fight the bushfires, you know, and saving lives. So that's a you know, my point.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's a very valid point. The fact that often we go to the arts to kind of, you know, raise the money, raise the awareness, and yet when they're in need.
And they're playing for free, you know. And, you know, some of these people, you know, they've got international careers and number one records, so they might not have, you know, needed the money. But, you know, there were backing vocalists and there were guitarists and there were drummers there. They're playing. I know some of them were friends of mine who all played for free, you know. The bushfires were consuming everything, so they're not going to say, "Can I have my $100, please?" or "Can I have my whatever their fee was?" They're going to say, "No, I'll give my time for free." They're the very same people that fell through the cracks, not the ones that had the number one hit. They don't need to play for funding, but the ones that really needed that fee, who forwent that fee, if that's the right verb, then couldn't apply for funding. So that's a tragedy, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's beautifully. Thank you for bringing up that really valid point. Look, this has just been an amazing conversation, and I knew it would. You know, I just really, you know, you've touched on things so much about, you know, money can be a very complex thing, and even for in our passions, it plays. And I'm going to continue doing these conversations, which following our passion, you know, because I think we often feel that we've got to sort of travel the road most trodden, and you know, hopefully this will be an inspiration for people to say, actually, I want to follow the thing that I love, which is probably what we need a little bit more of in the world, you know.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. So look, just to finish up, I always like to ask my guests these two really interesting questions, because we're talking about money and we're certainly talking about our relationship with money. Can you tell me a little bit about what money was like growing up?
Sure. Okay. So my parents were born in Alexandria, Egypt, and they're from Greek background. So they weren't native Egyptians, clearly. And in the mid-50s, the government, the Egyptian government, made it difficult for non-Egyptians to live there via taxing them more highly. So my father sought another place in the world to live. Greece's economy at the time wasn't great, so he knew somebody that lived in Sydney, Australia, a relative, and you know, the economy was booming here, and he heard it was a great country, you know, beaches, etc., the beautiful what we know Australia to be, and so he moved here. I mention all that to say, when he came out in 1956, he had no money. Absolutely no money. So he and my mother, you know, were renting and working and trying to make a living. And then he bought a house way up west where I was born. And when I was three, we came back into the inner city where I grew up. Now, I say all that to say that money was tight. But my father, even though he didn't work in something that he was passionate about, he was a cleaner. He worked hard. He worked really, really hard, and I guess I get a work ethic from him, but it's not as hard for me because I'm working hard for something that I love. He was working hard cleaning toilets, but he worked hard and he made things work, and he was a smart man, and so he formed his own business, and through hard, really, really hard work, he ended up getting the contract for the Hilton Hotel in the city, and that gave him money. And from that money, he bought houses. But, you know, so by the time I was a mid-teenager, we had a beautiful house with a view of the city, etc. But before then, money was tight. So my father, who was a beautifully generous man and a beautiful man, he was a very loving, giving, emotional father, hands-on, hugging father, was also really, money was a big issue for him. Probably the only problem I had was when I was older and I was making money, and he was, and I was living, working, I should say, and he was still alive. the only thing that upset me a little bit was that he asked me if I was, you know, what my salary was, and not that I minded what the figure was or telling him what the figure was, but he was making a focus of that question, and I was happy to answer. You know, I didn't want I wanted him to know that I was okay, and that's why he was asking. But I would have liked him to have said, "How's your job going? What concerts did? What was your last concert like? Can I come to the next one?" or something like that, and then ask me, "Are you okay? Are you getting enough money? Can I help you?" Mm-hmm. But he, because of his background, and that's why I mentioned everything about Egypt and going out west, because of that, even though he was a very loving and giving and very generous man financially as well, money was such an issue for him, and it was his number one thing that he would inquire about and talk about all the time. Now, I'm not against that. I just wish it was at least number two after talking, finding out how I am, you know, with the heart and things like that, rather than that. But that's where I, in answer to the question, I guess it's a very long and roundabout answer, but money was always a thing because of what I just mentioned about his background. Now, he then made money and he had houses, and we had a holiday home up the Central Coast, and then he bought a beautiful home in Brighton Les Sands. You know, we were okay, but at first we were really, really tight. We went to government schools, so he didn't have to pay for private education. He probably wouldn't have been able to pay for a private education when we started school, or maybe even high school. But by the time we were in mid high school, late high school, he could have afforded a private education for us, you know, twice over. So yeah, that's our money.
Yeah. And so what do you think that upbringing taught you about money, or what did it sort of, you know, what was built in your mind's eye or your understanding of money, do you think?
Well, interestingly, to go to our topic, notwithstanding all of that, or maybe even because of all of that, I never wanted to, ideally for me, it was always the dream to do something for a living that I would have, I know it's a cliche again, that I would have done for free. So to make money from something that I'm so passionate about, because it was a big thing, you know, money as I was growing up, and it was a big thing for my father, I guess I therefore, maybe even as a reaction against that, I wanted to make sure that I didn't have a job I didn't want a job just because of what it paid me. Mm-hmm. I wanted a job that, you know, nourished me and completed me, so to speak, to use like a romantic movie term. You know, I wanted a job that made me feel so amazing that the money was a bonus. I didn't know that I would find that, but as I said, from when I started at the conservatorium, that's where it all sprang. It all sprang from there. Mm-hmm. So, I guess because it was, as it was such an important thing, I wanted it to, I know it is important, but I didn't want it to be all based around that. And luckily I haven't. And to use your term, I have, followed the untraveled path and, you know, followed my passion. Luckily for me, and it was a dream. I didn't know I could achieve it, but luckily I have. It also, my dream job also pays me and pays me, if I may say, especially at times well.
Mm, yeah. So just finishing up, this is kind of an interesting question. You know, we don't often get much guidance around money or how we need to be with money or our relationship with money. Yeah. Beyond investment strategies and things like that, you know, of course that doesn't sound interesting to you, but is there a way you would have longed to be taught about how to be in the world in a way with money, with, you know, what was it that you were kind of longing that your dad sat you down and went, you know, George, in the way that you would have loved to have heard it for you?
Yeah. Yes. I would have liked that. I didn't get it. I didn't ask for it. Maybe I should have. My dad probably would have had some strategy. But if I may be so simple, and I don't know if this is helpful to your to this discussion. Basically, what I learned from my dad was, if you work hard, you won't have a problem with money. If you work, whatever it is you're doing, whether it is a dream job like, you know, the one you've got, or whether it's, you know, doing whatever, any other job you can think of, if you work hard at it, you won't be short. You might not necessarily be a billionaire, but if you work hard at money, if you work hard at your job, you will always be okay with money. And how, maybe the essence of your question is, you know, how is it, what is it that you do with your money? Well, a standard, of course, and everybody knows this, it's not worth me saying for the podcast, but as long as you're not spending more than you're earning, and you're working and you're getting that money, you will always have money in the bank. And that's how, nobody's ever really taught me how to work with money, but two things I've done is worked hard and therefore made the money, and two, made sure that I haven't spent more than I earn. And you know, I've sometimes resorted to when I've been on salary, and I've been freelance for 20 years now. But when I was on salary before that, sometimes I asked my company or the institution I was working for to put my money into two accounts, only one of which I had access to. And so the other account that I didn't have access to was building up. And so if I ever needed it, I could go into that account via the bank, or a co-signatory or something like that. So there are strategies like that. But for me, if it's not too basic to say, that is, work hard, you get the money, and then put that money away, use only what you need to have, enjoy it if you can, but don't spend more money than you have, and always keep on, even if it's $10 a week, make sure that that account is keeping on going up and never goes down. But it's easier to say if that money's coming in, harder to do when the money's not. And it's been up and down for me over the years. More earlier on, it was more down than up, and now it's more up than down. And the downs are very, less frequently together these days. So I'm a very, very lucky person.
Oh, George, thank you so much for this. It's been just really great. And I think it's just really lovely to hear, the perspective in the world from someone else, and particularly that someone that's following their passion. So thank you for your time. Thank you for being on Financial Therapy. And I really appreciate everything, all the golden nuggets you've given us.
I've been very lucky to be able to follow my passion. I highly recommend it. It doesn't maybe necessarily work for everybody all the time, but and that's unfortunate. But I really, really hope that anybody that asks me, should I follow my passion or not, only because it's worked for me, I will say a wholeheartedly yes, a big yes to that, and just cross my fingers that it works as well for them as fortunately has for me. And, there'll be times when in the next, maybe, who knows, next year or 5 or 10 years, that I might not get as much work as I'd like. Luckily, I'm in an okay place, but to me, much more important than whether I have $5 in the bank or, $5 million in the bank, which I certainly don't. Much more important than that is the fulfillment of what I do. And luckily, it pays me at least enough to be able to buy food and the things that I need.
Beautiful. Thanks, George Ellis.
Thanks, Jane. My pleasure. It's always great to talk with you, and I look forward to next time.
To find out more about the musical colour that George Ellis is putting out in the world, please read the show notes of this episode. And while you're there, please donate to the show, either by PayPal, or you can support me and my work through Patreon. This supports me to support others that may need help with them and money. And thank you for joining me.